Welcome, everyone, to our 10th program of the year. Please take this moment to silence your cell phones and your pagers. I want to remind you that our next speaker is in just 2 weeks, April 3rd, Susan Page, the Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. And she will tell us about what she thinks her impression is of the new administration's first 3 months. I'm sure you will have questions. Now I'd like to introduce the Reverend Chuck Carey from the Moorings Presbyterian Church to give the invocation.
Thank you very much, President Horton, and distinguished members of the Foreign Club. I'm very glad to be here and to bring greetings from the Moorings Presbyterian Church. Let us pray. Creator of the universe, you've given us the gift of food to nourish us, and you've given us life. Bless this food today, which you've made, and the human hands that have prepared it. May it satisfy our hunger, and in sharing it together, may we come closer to one another and to you. And as we gather, we remember those throughout the world in need, those who suffer, and we would ask that you would act in your own wonderful ways to bring relief, consolation, and hope to your people. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.
We have some guests we want you to meet, as we always do. And Shelley Church will now introduce our student guests.
Thanks, Alan. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to ask the students to come up as I'm introducing the school. We have students today from St. John Newman High School. And first of all, I want to acknowledge our board member, Bill Gunlix, who has sponsored the students today. Unfortunately, Bill's not with us, but let's give him a round of applause anyways. I'd like to also introduce Dr. Cheryl Sington, who has brought the students today. She's the one who's responsible for choosing the students, St. John Newman. She's the director of guidance. And Cheryl, would you like for you to stand, please? Now, too. Thank you. St. John Newman is the first and the oldest Catholic high school in Collier County. I believe it started in 1982. Am I right? Okay, good. That was a guess. I thought that was right. last year, the school had 100% acceptance of their seniors into colleges. They have a very unique program. It's the only school in the state of Florida. It's called the PACE program, which is a preparation program for college. And I think you're going to notice today with the prep that the students have relative to their talks, they actually are required to go through the PACE program in order to graduate from St. John Newman, and they actually start as freshmen. So in their senior year, they are totally prepared to make applications to colleges. So, and as you'll see, most of the kids today with us have already been accepted, so you'll get to hear where they're going. And please don't be shy about coming up and talking to them, because I think that's a great connection we have with members of alumni that have gone to the schools that these students will be attending. A very interesting note is that they had their first Quest Bridge Scholar this year, which is a program that matches the top academic students with the top colleges and universities across the U.S. Once these students and the colleges are matched, a full four-year ride to the college or university is paid in full. This year, one of the students will be attending Columbia University, and this is one of 250 students in the country that qualify. So, need to say, it's very impressive. So, I'm going to, without further ado, let the students come up and introduce themselves and tell you about themselves.
Hi, my name is Lauren Garrity, and I'm currently a senior at St. John Newman. And I hope to attend University of Miami in the fall, and I hope to major in English and eventually go on to study law and hopefully go to law school in New York and intern at my uncle's law firm and continue to study law. And those are my future goals, and if anyone is an alumni of University of Miami, I'd love to speak with you. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Olivia O'Brien. I'm also a senior at St. John Newman. I'm an active volunteer in the community. I'm a member of an organization called KidsCan. It's the junior board of the Cancer Alliance of Naples. And what we do is we plan events for the kids who have cancer themselves, who have cancer in their family. Like we did a Christmas party for them at Germain Arena, and they got to go see a hockey game, and Santa came and gave them presents, and it was really nice. And in the fall, I plan on attending the University of Miami and studying psychology. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Taylor Hallam. I'm also a senior at St. John Newman High School. I will be attending the University of Florida and studying architecture. Oh, I see a hand raised over there. Is that a gator? Nice. yes, and I want to go to the University of Texas for my master's degree after that, and then hopefully start my own firm.
Hi, my name is Julie Camity, and I am also a senior at St. John Newman. This upcoming summer, I'm going to the University of North Florida to study either pre-med or pre-pharmacy. Actually, really interesting fact about myself is I'm part of the People to People Student Ambassador Program, and ever since my freshman year of high school, I've been given the opportunity to travel to other countries overseas and, you know, learn about their culture and bring it into ours. If you, you know, want to talk to me, feel free to. Thanks.
My name is Natalie Brown. I am a senior at St. John Newman High School. I plan on attending Manhattan College and receiving a degree in biology. In my career, I aspire to leave a positive impression on the environment through wildlife conservation. In preparation for this vocation, I have participated in SeaWorld's Advanced Career Camp, a summer camp geared towards young adults pursuing careers in animal husbandry. I also volunteer at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida in the Wildlife Rehabilitation Clinic. The Conservancy has given me many hands-on opportunities to help wildlife while also confirming my passion for the environment.
Hi, I'm Danny Grasso. I am also a senior at St. John Newman. I am also a member of the Kids Can, as Olivia O'Brien is. We're very active with the children who have cancer around Naples. I plan on attending University of Tampa and studying sports medicine. Thank you.
And now I'd like to call on Roy White, who is the chairman of our education committee, to report on the give us a scholarship update.
Good morning. I imagine most of you would agree with me that today's economy is somewhat like the Titanic. But I think I'll get your attention if I give you a rock-solid investment tip. And this tip promises outstanding growth and one that will pay a guaranteed dividend for many, many years to come. I'm talking about giving a helping hand to young people who simply want to get a college education. These students have the potential to make our world and our lives a whole lot better. We can wait for the economy to turn around, but they can't. They need our help now. Starting next week, we'll commence interviewing students, needy students, and students who have had great achievements in their high school career for scholarships. Our goal is to grant 30 scholarships based on achievement and need. To reach that goal, we ask for your help. This will be our last chance for this year's funding campaign. Your investment in these kids will pay handsome dividends for many years to come. Look on your tables. There are a yellow form. We ask you to please take them home with you. Better still, fill them in as you have your dessert, and even better than that, write out a check to the Education Foundation of Collier County. Your investments in these students will appreciate and pay dividends. I'd like the interview teams, if they will, to stand and be recognized. Will you please do that? I'm pleased to tell you that each member of the Board of Directors of the Forum Club has participated in this program, and they've made contributions towards its success. And please remember that the Education Committee, the Forum Club Board of Directors, and last but certainly by no means least, the students, thank you. And so do I.
Enjoy your lunch, and we'll be back in about 25 minutes. Before I introduce our speaker, permit me to tell you something you already know. Most federal agency directors are relatively anonymous managers. Some are little more than caretakers. A few really shake up and re-energize state bureaucracies. Once in a while, a rare agency leader rises to huge historic challenges. Dr. Julie Gerberding was such a director. This former small-town South Dakota girl, daughter of the town police chief and a school teacher, must have marveled at how it was that fate placed her in the deputy director's position at the National Center for Infectious Diseases just in time to lead the Center for Disease Control's response to anthrax bioterrorism in 2001 and earned promotion in July 2002 to director for the CDC. 6.5 years later, she resigned, effective on President Obama's Inauguration Day. During those few years, she and her agency confronted the SARS, that's the acute respiratory syndrome epidemic, then the outbreak of the rare monkeypox virus and the widespread threat of West Nile virus, and on and on. Meanwhile, she had to ready the national health care systems for bioterrorism, and then, in 2004, began a massive reorganization of CDC. That's when the feathers flew, and I'm not talking about bird flu. Pardon the pun. Some people think I overdo those. To many, she was a hero. Time magazine said in 2005 that she was one of the 100 most influential people, and Forbes magazine over and over put her on their annual list of the 100 most powerful women in the world. In 2006, Harvard thought so much of her that she gave the Harvard School of Public Health's commencement address. Infectious disease expert, distinguished clinical professor of medicine specializing in infectious diseases at Emory University, early leader in advancing AIDS care and prevention, leader in disease prevention for 20 years, author of 140-plus peer-reviewed papers and book chapters. No question Dr. Gerberding left some disgruntled scientists, bureaucrats, and congressional inquirers in her wake as she reformed CDC. But she did not sit on her hands when fate gave her an opportunity to make a difference. Please don't sit on your hands as you help me welcome to our podium Dr. Julie Louise Gerberding.
Great introduction. Thank you for that fun introduction. I love it. It's really terrific to be here and to have a chance to have a conversation with you. Naples is an absolutely beautiful community that I've never visited before, and I hope I will be able to come back and sometime at the rest of the weekend, we will be enjoying the beach and hopefully the swamp and the birds and a few other things. But the dolphins were kind enough to parade in front of our hotel room this morning. So you're very lucky to live here. It's absolutely beautiful. I had a lovely dinner last night with Alan and friends, and we had a chance to get to know a little bit more about the background of the forum and also the community. And one of the things that Alan seemed the most proud of was how diverse this community is. They all come from so many backgrounds, from so many places around the country, with so many professional perspectives and some of your business interests, but also the investment here in culture and the arts and the museum. And it really is a microcosm of America. So I thought I would start this morning by acknowledging that some of you may be business analysts, probably not many of you, but I'm going to ask you to put a hat on as if you were an analyst, because I'm going to ask you to consider an investment decision. I'm going to describe for you the nature of what you might be purchasing. On the positive side of the purchase is that this is a global entity. It stretches universally around the world and very clearly across our country. It is capable of performing extraordinary miracles. It's capable of bringing extraordinary improvements in the quality of life to people everywhere. It's a very sophisticated set of transactions that are at stake here, and it's essential to not only the quality of our personal lives, but also our economic prosperity, our national security, and indeed the overall global development of the world. On the negative side, there's a mega amount of money at risk. Trillions and trillions of dollars are in play. This is a very complex entity that you would be considering an investment in, and we don't have any metrics to tell you how well it's performing or what the true value of it is, and in fact, a lot of the value of it is off the books. There is no real access among consumers for determining how well their particular piece of the portfolio is going to do over the long run, and it's run by experts who themselves really can't get their arms around the complexity and the vastness of the system. It's not well regulated. The incentives are not well aligned with performance and reward. In fact, bonuses are given for people who don't necessarily produce the best results. And ultimately, it is a system that's characterized by enormous disparities between the people who benefit from the system and the people who aren't getting any benefit at all. Now, what does that sound like? So would you, if you were making those decisions today, would you invest in this system? To me, it seems like a pretty high-risk venture, and if you read Fortune or the Wall Street Journal, as I did this morning, we'd know that these characteristics are some of the adjectives that are being used to describe our financial sector, and the people who are trying to understand what happened and why are reflecting on what was wrong with the network and what was wrong with the system that got us into such a catastrophic situation. But I would maintain that those same characteristics describe our health system. It is a vast global enterprise that is capable of performing miracles. And I believe our health system is absolutely essential to the quality of our lives, but also our economic prosperity, our national security, and our ability to develop and address equities around the world. But our health system is a system that has trillions of dollars at risk, even just in our country. It's a system that's incredibly complex. Consumers have no way of knowing what the value of their investment is. We don't measure health. We measure all kinds of other things, but we absolutely, can you tell me what the health status of Naples is? We don't really measure the outcome that we're hoping to get from our system. There is huge disparity, haves, have-nots, but also people who have drastically different outcomes from their participation in the network. And basically, from where I sat for 6.5 years at the CDC and reflected upon the state of our health, our preparedness, our health promotion, our prevention capabilities, I believe that our health system is equally vulnerable to a massive meltdown because we are absolutely not getting the value out of it compared to the investment that we deserve. Let me give you a few chilling perspectives on this. We spend, as you know, in terms of investment dollars in the traditional sense of what we spend on health, more than $2.2 trillion on our system, far more than any other country. But we don't even rank in the top 10 of health status among developed countries. We're 27th in infant mortality, we're 39th by other measures. Overall, when the WHO puts the value of what we're spending and the health we get out of our system, we're 47th in the world. That's not a good investment, and I don't think any of us would want to put our retirement accounts into that kind of a situation. But more importantly, I know many of you have grandchildren, and if we don't do something drastically different in our nation, your grandchildren will be the first generation who will have shorter life expectancies than their parents, because our obesity, our poor fitness, our poor nutrition are beginning to add up at earlier and earlier days, so that we're seeing an outbreak of diabetes among high school students and college students who are now at the risk for cardiovascular disease that their grandparents were 40 years ago. So we are facing catastrophic conditions, not to mention the demographic variables that are aging our population, the cost drivers that are increasing the amount of investment necessary to achieve any given increment of healthcare, and the overall lack of true solutions to the preventable part of our health dilemmas that we face. I love the quote that Warren Buffett provided. He gives many good quotes, quite a few interesting ones in these days, but this was one from a while back where he said, you know, GM is really a health insurance company that happens to make cars on the side. Is really recognizing that this isn't just about health. It's about our economic prosperity and our ability to compete in the global market. And it's not just GM and Ford. It's every business that's providing employee benefits and every small business who's really struggling to keep and retain people who are underinsured or uninsured and are suffering from these chronic consequences. So Americans obviously are very worried. We're a smart nation. We know that these are sober pieces of information and that we need to take action. We're worried about our own insurance, we're worried about our children, we're worried about our communities, and we voted for change in November, expecting the new administration to be able to come in and not only tackle our trade deficit, but also to tackle our national health deficit. And we do indeed have a national health deficit. So where are we now in terms of that health deficit? What is the conversation? What is the debate? How far have we come to this point in terms of really coming to grips with what we need to be doing to become a healthiest nation? Well, the first approach is the one that you're reading about, and that's the fix the problem approach. And what people are talking about is affordable access to quality healthcare delivery services. People want more people to have insurance, they want insurance to be more affordable, and they want the quality of the care that many are receiving to improve. And that certainly is a part of the problem. Of course people need health insurance. I don't know if I would argue it's a right or a responsibility of a society, but certainly it's something that I believe everybody deserves to be able to enjoy. The solutions to this particular fix, or the fix to this problem, is really concentrating in the domain of what will the government do to add to insurability and regulate better to improve quality and cost. I worked for the government for 10 years. I am not convinced that the government is the epitome of efficiency. I've stood in line at the post office a week or so ago, and I just shook my head and said, oh dear, if this is the direction we're going to go in our health system, we're in trouble, and we need to be very careful about how we think about the government responsibility for either owning, operating, or organizing our health system. And those are some really important choices that we have to make, because they'll lead to very different decisions about the solution. But let's just say that we have enough will, political will and wisdom, to be able to design a system that really does reach everybody who deserves basic health benefits. Will we be the healthiest nation if we do that? And the answer is no, we will not. The economists say that even if we had great health services for everyone, at most we would make up 25% of the differential between where we are as a nation and where we would like to be or where we should be, given how much value and money we're putting into it. So how do we get the other 75%? Well, part of the dilemma is our failure to recognize that health doesn't actually happen in the healthcare delivery system. You don't go there to get healthy. You go there because you've got a problem and you need disease care or disease treatment. And yes, we can talk about clinical prevention services, but by and large, those are about screening or attacking certain risk factors. They're not really about promoting health and well-being. Health doesn't happen there. Health happens at home. It happens in the school. It happens in community settings. It happens in the workplace. Health happens all over the map, but very little of it is going to come out of our healthcare delivery system. And for those of us in public health, we've been preaching this message for 100 years, and we all believe it. But we have really failed to engage the most important partners in taking the kinds of actions necessary to do something about it. One of those very important partners and stakeholders is, of course, the business community. And only recently have we been able to say there is an alliance between the business imperative to have a healthy, more productive workforce and a benefits cost that doesn't erode the bottom line of profitability, and the public health interest in assuring that populations of people have the best opportunity, the most equitable opportunity to thrive and grow. So if we want to create more health, we're going to have to think about how to do that in the places where it's realistic to expect health to emerge. I don't have all the answers here, but I'm going to give you three ways that I think we should be at least debating a way forward for health to emerge. One is to think about health in all places. And I would start with schools. I'm not going to ask our students to answer this question, but most schools are anything but healthy. Take a good look at the school lunch program in most schools. Ask yourself, how much nutrition do you think it's realistic to be able to provide for $1.90 a meal? Is that a meal you would ever serve in your own home? And that's the food that students are getting on a daily basis. They may be meeting nutritional standards, but they're certainly not meeting food standards. But then we can talk about exercise in schools. And despite all of the attention on obesity and the deplorable state of our children's health, we still have a majority of school systems that do not have compulsory physical education because they can't afford it and they can't squeeze it in amidst all of the other pressures that schools are under to be able to provide education and test scores and so on that schools need. So we're going to have to figure out how to put health in all places. How many of you have been to New York recently? So did you go to Starbucks and get a muffin? Because if you did, you would have noticed something very interesting. It tells you how many calories are in the muffin. And you can stand in the counter in Starbucks and you can see all the different temptations and you can do the math to figure out, do I want an 800 calorie muffin or do I want a 200 calorie muffin? And you can decide for the 800, but then you know that you just put an 800 calorie brand muffin in your stomach. It's not anything you can hide away from. So Starbucks is learning how to put health in our choices, which really brings me to a concept that we are just beginning to tap into, and that's the concept of nudging. It's the way of building in healthier choices automatically into the kinds of things that people do every day. And there's a great book called Nudge, written by two economists, that shows how you can create more health and wellness by not taking away people's freedom of choice or their civil liberties, but by kind of nudging them in a better direction. At CDC, we nudged people into taking the stairwells in our campuses by making them absolutely beautiful and putting them in the center of our $1.6 billion capital improvement plan. So if you come into a new CDC building, the stairwell is right there. And if you happen to be in one of our old buildings, you'll find that many of the staircases have been painted, carpeted, and have children's art in them because the employees bring their children's pictures and put them in the staircase. And our evidence, our science, tells us that that really does get people taking the stairs. Of course, if you want them to continue to take the stairs, you also have to put music in the stairwell because that creates the sustainable nudge to get that good feeling that you can get when there's some lively music in the staircase. But nudging is beginning to occur everywhere. Even our House of Representatives has learned to nudge people in the House cafeteria. Not only do they publish all the content of the foods there and give them cheat sheets with red, yellow, green lights so that the congressman can take shortcuts and don't have to think too much about what they're eating, but also they are organized the food so that when you come in, the first thing you don't see is the pizza and the cookies. You see the salads and the nutritious foods. So you are nudged into selecting the good foods first, and then after you've filled your tray, maybe you won't be so tempted by the things that are less healthy for you down the road. You can also nudge in a company cafeteria by differential pricing. So if the salad really is the bargain and you charge more for the difficult foods, you're nudging people into making an economic choice that's more rational based on their desire to save resources. So nudging is a phenomenon that is probably going to be a much more effective way of influencing people's health behaviors than teaching them that it's bad to be obese or telling them that they shouldn't smoke cigarettes. In fact, the success that we've had with the tobacco cessation and non-smoking campaigns in America have been largely done through nudging, by raising the price of tobacco, by making it very difficult for people to smoke in environments, and I congratulate the hospital for working in that direction here. If you're working